Chapter 58. You're a head of swine. Judy, not interested in what she has often heard, begins to collect in a basin various tributary streams of tea, from the bottoms of cups and saucers, and from the bottom of the teapot for the little charwoman's evening meal. In like manner she gets together, in the iron bread basket, as many outside fragments and worn down heels of loaves as the rigid economy of the house has left in existence. But your father and me were partners, Bart, says the old gentleman, and when I am gone, you and Judy will have all there is. It's rare for you both, that you went out early in life, Judy to the flower business, and you to the law. You won't want to spend it. You'll get your living without it, and put more to it. When I am gone, Judy will go back to the flower business and you will still stick to the law. One might infer from Judy's appearance that her business rather lay with the thorns than the flowers, but she has in her time been apprenticed to the art and mystery of artificial flower making. A close observer might perhaps detect both in her eye and her brother's, when their venerable grandsire anticipates his being gone, some little impatience to know when he may be going, and some resentful opinion that it is time he went. Now, if everybody has done, says Judy, completing her preparations, I'll have that girl into her tea. She would never leave off if she took it by herself in the kitchen. Charlie is accordingly introduced, and under a heavy fire of eyes, sits down to her basin and a druidical ruin of bread and butter. In the active superintendence of this young person, Judy Smallweed appears to attain a perfectly geological age, and to date from the remotest periods. Her systematic manner of flying at her, and pouncing on her, with or without pretense, whether or no, is wonderful, evincing an accomplishment in the art of girl driving seldom reached by the oldest practitioners. Now, don't stare about you all the afternoon, cries Judy, shaking her head and stamping her foot as she happens to catch the glance which has been previously sounding the basin of tea, but take your victuals, and get back to your work. Yes, miss, says Charlie. Don't say yes, returns Miss Smallweed, for I know what you girls are. Do it without saying it, and then I may begin to believe you. Charlie swallows a great gulp of tea in token of submission, and so disperses the druidical ruins that Miss Smallweed charges her not to gormandize, which in you girls, she observes, is disgusting. Charlie might find some more difficulty in meeting her views on the general subject of girls, but for a knock at the door. See who it is, and don't chew when you open it, cries Judy. The object of her attentions withdrawing for the purpose, Miss Smallweed takes that opportunity of jumbling the remainder of the bread and butter together, and launching two or three dirty teacups into the ebb tide of the basin of tea as a hint that she considers the eating and drinking terminated. Now, who is it, and what's wanted? Says the snappish Judy. It is one Mr. George, it appears. Without other announcement or ceremony, Mr. George walks in. Whew, says Mr. George. You are hot here. Always a fire, eh? Well, perhaps you do right to get used to one. Mr. George makes the latter remark to himself as he nods to Grandfather Smallweed. Oh, it's you, cries the old gentleman. How did you? Middling, replies Mr. George, taking a chair. Your granddaughter I have had the honor of seeing before. My service to you, miss. This is my grandson, says Grandfather Smallweed. You haven't seen him before. He is in the law, and not much at home. My service to him too. He is like his sister. He is very like his sister. He is devilish like his sister, says Mr. George, laying a great, and not altogether complimentary stress on his last adjective. And how does the world use you, Mr. George? Grandfather Smallweed inquires, slowly rubbing his legs. Pretty much as usual. Like a football. He is a swarthy brown man of 50, well made, and good looking, with crisp dark hair, bright eyes, and a broad chest. His sinewy and powerful hands, as sunburned as his face, have evidently been used to a pretty rough life. What is curious about him is that he sits forward on his chair, as if he were, from long habit, allowing space for some dresser accoutrements that he has altogether laid aside. His step too is measured and heavy, and would go well with a weighty clash and jingle of spurs. He is close-shaved now, but his mouth is set, as if his upper lip had been for years familiar with a great mustache, and his manner of occasionally laying the open palm of his broad brown hand upon it is to the same effect. Altogether one might guess Mr. George to have been a trooper once upon a time. A special contrast Mr. George makes to the Smallweed family. Trooper was never yet billeted upon a household more unlike him. It is a broadsword to an oyster knife. His developed figure and their stunted forms, his large manner filling any amount of room, and their little narrow pinched ways, his sounding voice and their sharp spare tones, are in the strongest and the strangest opposition. As he sits in the middle of the grim parlor, leaning a little forward, with his hands upon his thighs and his elbows squared, he looks as though, if he remained there long, he would absorb into himself the whole family, and the whole four-roomed house, extra little back kitchen and all. "Do you rub your legs, to rub life into 'em?" he asks of Grandfather Smallweed, after looking round the room. "Why, it's partly a habit, Mr. George, and yes, it partly helps the circulation," he replies. "The circle cubic lotion," repeats Mr. George, folding his arms upon his chest and seeming to become two sizes larger. "Not much of that, I should think." "Truly I'm old, Mr. George," says Grandfather Smallweed. "But I can carry my years. I'm older than her," nodding at his wife. "And see what she is? You're a brimstone chatterer." With a sudden revival of his late hostility. "Unlucky old soul," says Mr. George, turning his head in that direction. "Don't scold the old lady. Look at her here, with her poor cap half off her head and her poor hair all in a muddle. Hold up, ma'am. That's better. There we are. Think of your mother, Mr. Smallweed," says Mr. George, coming back to his seat from assisting her, "if your wife and enough. I suppose you were an excellent son, Mr. George," the old man hints with a leer. The color of Mr. George's face rather deepens as he replies, "Why no, I wasn't. I am astonished at it. So am one. I ought to have hands to Mr. George, who twists it up for a pipe light." As the old man inspects, through his glasses, every upstroke and downstroke of both documents, before he releases them from their leathern prison, and as he counts the money three times over and requires Judy to say every word she utters at least twice, and is as tremulously slow of speech and action as it is possible to be, this business is a long time in progress. When it is quite concluded, and not before, he disengages his ravenous eyes and fingers from it, and answers Mr. George's last remark by saying, afraid to order the pipe. "We are not so mercenary as that, sir." "Judy, see directly to the pipe and the glass of cold brandy and water for Mr. George." The sportive twins, who have been looking straight before them all this time except when they have been engrossed by the black leathern cases, retire together, generally disdainful of the visitor, but leaving him to the old man as two young cubs might leave a traveler to the parental bear. "And there you sit, I suppose, all the day long, eh?" says Mr. George with folded arms. Just so," the old man nods. "And don't you occupy yourself at all?" "I watch the fire and the boiling, and the roasting, when there is any," says Mr. George with great expression. "Just so, when there is any. Don't you read or get read to?" The old man shakes his head with sharp, sly triumph. "No, no. We have never been readers in our family. It don't pay. Stuff. Idleness. Folly. No, no. There's not much to choose between your two states," says the visitor in a key too low for the old man's dull hearing as he looks from him to the old woman and back again. "I say," in a louder voice, "I hear you. You'll sell me up at last, I suppose, when I am a day in arrear. My dear friend, cries Grandfather Smallweed, stretching out both hands to embrace him. Never, never, my dear friend. But my friend in the city that I got to lend you the money he might. Oh, you can't answer for him? Says Mr. George, finishing the inquiry in his lower key with the words, you lying old rascal. My dear friend, he is not to be depended on. I wouldn't trust him. He will have his bond, my dear friend. Devil doubt him, says Mr. George. Charlie appearing with a tray, on which are the pipe, a small paper of tobacco, and the brandy and water, he asks her, how do you come here? You haven't got the family face. I goes out to work, sir, returns Charlie. The trooper, if trooper he be or have been, takes her bonnet off, with a light touch for so strong a hand, and pats her on the head. You give the house almost a wholesome look. It wants a bit of youth as much as it wants fresh air. Then he dismisses her, lights his pipe, and drinks to Mr. Smallweed's friend in the city the one solitary flight of that esteemed old gentleman's imagination. So you think he might be hard upon me, eh? I think he might, I am afraid he would. I have known him do it, says Grandfather Smallweed incautiously, 20 times. Incautiously, because his stricken better half, who has been dozing over the fire for some time, is instantly aroused, and jabbers 20,000 pounds, 20 20-pound notes in a money box, 20 guineas, 20 million, 20%, 20, and is then cut short by the flying cushion, which the visitor, to whom this singular experiment appears to be a novelty, snatches from her face as it crushes her in the usual manner. You're a brimstone idiot. You're a scorpion, a brimstone scorpion. You're a sweltering toad. You're a chattering, clattering broomstick witch, that ought to be burnt. Gasps the old man, prostrate in his chair. My dear friend, will you shake me up a little? Mr. George, who has been looking first at one of them, and then at the other, as if he were demented, takes his venerable acquaintance by the throat on receiving this request, and dragging him upright in his chair as easily as if he were a doll, appears in two minds, whether or no to shake all future power of cushioning out of him, and shake him into his grave. Resisting the temptation, but agitating him violently enough, to make his head roll like a harlequin's, he puts him smartly down in his chair again, and adjusts his skull cap with such a rub, that the old man winks with both eyes for a minute afterwards. Oh Lord! Gasps Mr. Smallweed. That'll do. Thank you, my dear friend, that'll do. Oh, dear me, I'm out of breath. Oh Lord! And Mr. Smallweed says it, not without evident apprehensions of his dear friend, who still stands over him looming larger than ever. The alarming presence, however, gradually subsides into its chair, and falls to smoking in long puffs, consoling itself with the philosophical reflection, the name of your friend in the city begins with a D, comrade, and you're about right respecting the bond. Did you speak, Mr. George? Inquires the old man. The trooper shakes his head, and leaning forward with his right elbow on his right knee, and his pipe supported in that hand, while his other hand, resting on his left leg, squares his left elbow in a martial manner, continues to smoke. Meanwhile he looks at Mr. Smallweed with grave attention and now, and then fans the cloud of smoke away in order that he may see him the more clearly. I take it, he says, making just as much, and as little change in his position as will enable him to reach the glass to his lips with a round, full action, that I am the only man alive or dead either that gets the value of a pipe out of you. Well, returns the old man, it's true that I don't see company, Mr. George, and that I don't treat. I can't afford to it. But as you, in your pleasant way, made your pipe a condition, why, it's not for the value of it, that's no great thing. It was a fancy, to get it out of you. To have something in for my money. Ha! You're prudent, prudent, sir! Cries Grandfather Smallweed, rubbing his legs. Very. I always was. Puff! It's a sure sign of my prudence, that I ever found the way here. Puff! also, that I am what I am. Puff. I am well known to be prudent, says Mr. George, composedly smoking. I rose in life that way. Don't be downhearted, sir. You may rise yet. Mr. George laughs and drinks. Had you no relations now, asks Grandfather Smallweed with a twinkle in his eyes, who would pay off this little principal, or who would lend you a good name or two, that I could persuade my friend in the city, to make you a further advance upon? Two good names would be sufficient for my friend in the city. Had you no such relations, Mr. George? Mr. George, still composedly smoking, replies, if I had, I... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.